This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear about a recent victory in the case of arrested artist and activist Lori Arbiter.
Hear how the case against Lori and others was thrown out, even though they went into the Hart office building with a long march and a big poster, March of the Dead.
We'll talk with noted attorney Len Weinglass on the Supreme Court's recent denial to hear the case of the Cuban Five.
In a really shocking decision, the Supreme Court refused to hear the case of the Cuban Five, a case that has caused outrage throughout the world.
Stay with us.
Heidi, as you know, we often follow the progress or non-progress of the use of stun guns. It goes on and on. And one question that came up recently, I know, was whether you could actually stun gun someone to get their DNA, even though they were passively sitting on the ground. And, of course, some bad state court judge said you could. But I know there's another, at least more positive development in the stun gun area. So why don't you tell us what that is?
Last week, Moberly, Missouri, actually agreed in a settlement to an indefinite moratorium on the use of stun guns, and they're going to pay $2.4 million to survivors of a young man who died after the police shocked him with a taser.
You know, that's quite remarkable, actually. That means none in Missouri?
It's an indefinite moratorium. Yeah, the moratorium is going to continue until two town hall meetings there are held, and the police department issues a revised policy on tasers.
Oh, but it's just Moberly. It's not the whole state
of
Missouri.
It's just Moberly. Well, they may be small, Michael, but they have a big conscience.
No, what's interesting is that, you know, I litigate these cases. Several million-dollar settlement for a young child, usually it's just the way around. They argue, well, the kid is going to require money to grow up. He's not going to give you anything. And that kind of really sends a message, that kind of settlement.
It does, Michael. And the readout on the officer's taser, because you know it keeps track of how many times someone is stunned, said that the 23-year-old Harlan, is his name, was stunned three times. He lost consciousness, died a short time later. He has a one-year-old child.
Oh my gosh.
Conflicting stories from the police and the family lawyer. Police say they stopped him for suspected drunken driving. Statement from the lawyers, I don't know how they got this, said he was accused merely of speeding. The point is he argued with the police and that's why they stunned him.
Yeah, well, that's what you can't do. You can't challenge their authority or they go wild on you.
But one other good thing is they're going to issue the revised taser policy. They've also agreed to assign at least one automatic external defibrillator to an on-duty patrol unit. And they're going to require additional training on topics.
That is sick. So first they give a guy a heart attack and then they revive him?
It's like sending a doctor along with a cop so after he shoots you, you can have the doctor take the bullet out. Well, Heidi, I mean, it's some progress. Wherever Moberly, Missouri is, we applaud Moberly, Missouri.
Well, I'm sure we have listeners down there, and I'm sure this is of interest locally.
Stop being so provincial. We're both from the Midwest. What's next?
Well, some good news. According to the Associated Press last week, Department of Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano plans to eliminate a spy satellite program. This, according to a government official who spoke on condition of anonymity. But the program had been proposed under the Bush administration 2 years ago. It's called the National Applications Office. It hadn't been implemented because of numerous privacy and civil liberties concerns. What it would have done was given access to local and state law enforcement officials high-resolution overhead and mapping imagery from existing satellites for Homeland Security and law enforcement to use. The purposes they cited would have been border security, disaster relief efforts, and to help secure large events such as the Super Bowl.
Yeah, right.
But Janet Napolitano, as soon as she was confirmed, ordered a review of the program and apparently wants to stop it.
Something positive, but of course it's all in the context of massive government spying that's going on. Look, it's obviously every time we cut back spying a little bit is an important development. It's in the context of the National Security Agency, which under the law that Obama voted for when he was a senator, allows much broader warrantless wiretapping, or through the warrant court supposedly, the secret court, of Americans. And what they found is massive
electronic surveillance of our emails, massive, way beyond what the court had authorized. Millions of emails that are just being taken in and swept in, domestic emails in the United States. So while I think this is great, and the fact that they won't be able to tell what kind of hat I'm wearing any longer, at least the local police, with what kind of logo is on it, that it is, we have to understand, it's a positive step.
If it happens, it's just a proposal.
Good point. She has expressed desire. It's in the 2010 budget. In a related story, and we've done several segments on Vera chips and what we call spy chips, airport security company Verified Identity Pass, which operated the so-called CLEAR security service, where passengers waiting to get on an airplane can speedily go through, they're scanned, is planning to close shop.
Their irises are scanned.
Their irises, exactly. What they did was they collected personal identification information on members. So you had to be a member to be a part of this plan, including iris scans and fingerprints. But what's of concern now that they're closing down is what's going to happen to all the sensitive membership data it compiled. And as an example, in 2008, following the loss of a laptop containing all this customer data, the CLEAR service was temporarily suspended by the Transportation Security Administration. So how are they going to dispose of this data?
I'm sure the way they normally dispose of data. They're going to sell it to organizations that keep huge data banks. And then help out, you know, everybody from private investigators to the government. So I'm glad I never joined the VIP program, actually.
Well, it costs you $100 and then they take a scan of your iris, and then you could jump the line because they'd look into your eyes. So much for the people who thought that they'd get their money's worth on $100. They will get their money's
exactly.
worth.
Well, exactly. When people are complaining that they've paid 3 years in advance and they're losing this fast way through to the airline.
So think about that. The people who thought they were the most secure, could get through, who were not close to being, you know, any involvement in anything questionable, according to the government, are now going to get all their records, including their iris scans, turned over to who knows who for
the
money.
The irony is staggering.
No, I tried to do it, but when they did the iris scan, they could see the back of my head. That was a problem. We don't mean to make fun of the iris scan. But we are.
We should.
All those foolish people who thought they could jump the line over anybody with a Muslim-sounding name. This will fix your wagons.
Well, what else is happening?
Speaking of irises, let's talk about DNA because we have an unfortunate development from the Supreme Court in this area.
On June 18th, we had an extremely disappointing Supreme Court decision. The usual 5-4 anti-constitutional, anti-progressive, anti-liberal Judge Kennedy going with the majority, Judge Roberts writing the decision. It's an interesting case. 47 states allow post-conviction, which is after a person's been convicted, a post-conviction test of their DNA to see if they might be innocent after they're convicted. Three states don't, which is Alaska, Massachusetts, and Oklahoma. This case came out of Alaska. The prisoner who was sentenced for rape, been all through conviction appeal, wants, because now there's apparently some question, wants to have a DNA test. And Alaska actually, on a simple test that he would pay for at his own expense, which costs like, it's not high, Alaska refused to allow him to have a DNA test, which would clearly, in his case, prove his innocence or guilt, because it's a rape case and they would be able to tell whether there was a match or not. And the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, turned it down. Roberts writing the opinion, basically saying, it's up to the states, the state legislators, to decide this. But even more saying, we have to weigh at some point finality against innocence, essentially. I mean, I'm paraphrasing and saying that at some point we can't just allow this to happen willy-nilly. So it's an absolutely awful decision.
I'm stunned that Massachusetts doesn't have any laws on this.
Yeah, it is surprising, actually. I imagine they will. But what was interesting is, to me as a constitutional lawyer, is that normally when a case like this goes to the Supreme Court, the question is whether there's a constitutional right. They look to the other states and see what the states have done. If a majority of the states or a lot of states have done it, they said, well, it's a time maybe we should say this is a fundamental right or an important right. And here they did the opposite. They said the fact that 47 states have done it means that it's really up to the states and we'll let the other states determine it on their own. It's a real indication of where this court is going.
in terms of saying the court is going to take a much more passive role, which is actually very bad.
Opportunistically takes a passive role.
I think that's important.
You know, look at Bush versus Gore, you know, when instead of saying it's up to the states to decide who got elected in Florida, they stepped in and stole the election.
I think that's right.
You know, these people are crooks.
On January 6, 2009, artist and activist Lori Arbeiter joined 70 others from around the country for the March of the Dead. Participants assembled in Washington, first before the Capitol, and then inside the Hart office building where they unfurled several banners. They began to read the names of those killed in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Palestine before the Capitol Police interrupted the event and arrested 17 people. Four of them, including Lori, appeared in court last week on charges of unlawful assembly and disorderly conduct, where the judge nullified their case. Lori is a member of the Critical Voice, which started the We Will Not Be Silent t-shirt campaign, and she joins us today. Welcome back, Lori, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me back.
Well, you come here today with wonderful news from last week. Can you explain to our listeners what happened?
Sure. Well, last week, four of us were put on trial by the government for an action that we did in January 6th. That was the first day of the 111th Congress. And as they were being sworn in, people came from all over the country to circle the Capitol in death masks, carrying the names of the dead from Iraq, Afghanistan, and Gaza. Well, on that day, 17 of us were arrested, and then four of us were brought all the way to trial. So last week, we went into court, and we're facing charges of disorderly conduct and unlawful assembly. I have to say, we didn't get to mount our case because of the gross incompetence of the government, including tampering with evidence. They destroyed evidence, and that was the very first thing that came out.
And were those videotapes?
Those were videotapes.
But talk about the action itself, because it was really creative and dramatic and the kind of thing that we have to encourage.
Okay, I'll give you the background. We marched, as I said, around the Capitol. It was very solemn, quite a stark to see a long line. We do a single line procession, and we carry the names of civilians and soldiers that have been killed, and from 2001 all the way up to the most recent names we could get. We did that with no incident. We were followed by the police, both on bicycles and on motorcycles throughout the day. But then in the afternoon, we decided to bring the procession inside the halls of Congress, as close as we could get. So we went into the Senate Hart building, and actually Senator Schumer has his office right upstairs. And on the floor of the atrium, we continued with the March of the Dead. There were people in death masks who stood silently, and others who then read the names reverently from Iraq, Afghanistan, and the recent civilians that had been massacred in Gaza. At the same time, another group hung banners, and they were billboard-sized banners, one naming Afghanistan, one saying Iraq, one saying Palestine, and then a huge banner that was 30 by 30, almost a small building, dropped down that said the audacity of war crimes. And then finally, the last banner came moments later that said, we will not be silent. And that was the backdrop. And we continued to read the names until the Capitol Police, and there were many more of them than us, surrounded us with bullhorns, gave us warnings, and disrupted our right to assembly and free speech, and then arrested us.
Lori, they dropped these charges against a lot of people, but they continued on against you. And it seems suspicious to me that they knew who you were and they selectively attempted to prosecute you.
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up, because when we did the solemn procession, actually, when we first came up to pass the Supreme Court, that was the first building on our way to circle the Capitol, the police on bikes were waiting for us. And I was the first one. I'm usually in the lead to lead the procession, behind a death mask, though. And a police officer started taunting me, pointing at me, saying, we know who you are.
Oh, really?
Wow. Yes. And so,
what were you feeling when they said that inside the death mask?
Well, it just makes me feel more defiant. I feel that that's totally inappropriate. And what we're doing is actually, as Barack Obama said, people who are on the fighting for justice will be on the right side of history. And I think he was speaking to the people in Iran, but
I love that, because when I thought about that statement, which is obviously what you're thinking about, you thought about your role at the RNC, at the Republican National Convention in Minneapolis when you were arrested, thought about what happened in New York when they massively arrested people, and of course when I was a young activist in the 70s and they just went after people massively, and to hear the administration now, of course, condemning Iran, which of course should be condemned, that's not the point, but to say as if we're some kind of paragon of justice.
Well, that statement is going to come back to bite him in the you-know-where.
That points to the fact that, Lori, probably your photo and information about you is in the law enforcement's possession as they gather information on so-called leaders, and you are and have been.
Well, I guess, yeah, they are looking at some of us, but they should look at each and every one of us, because each and every one of us at this point is leading the fight for justice. I'm just one of many, and I, you know, stand proudly in solidarity with all the other people that came from all over the country.
We're speaking with Lori Arbeiter, fresh from a victory in Washington last week when she got acquitted of disorderly conduct charges and unlawful assembly charges.
Michael and I were upstate, and we were talking about you're going to trial, and Michael said, "This, you know, I don't like the way this looks, because they picked out Lori, they knew who she was, and they're going forward with charges, and for all I know, Lori could do some jail time." Well, it didn't work out that way, and when we got the message, we were just completely shocked. But why don't you give us some sense of the trial? How many people were on trial? Who was your lawyer?
Sure. There were four of us on trial, Michelle Grisey, Pete Perry, and Robbie Dessoux. And the three of them actually decided to go pro se. And I had an attorney named Rick Iverson. So we went into the court not knowing what would happen, of course. And we were ready to mount a very serious and competent defense. It opened up with the government, of course, bringing on their first and only witness, which was a police officer who, you know, shockingly, when it's you they're telling this the lies about, it's just stunning. They just kept saying how loud he said loud and loudly, as many, that's all he said, and then there were a few other phrases in between, but he kept talking about how loud and that we were disruptive and we were loud. And the fact of the matter is that in this particular action, I actually stood silently within a death mask, and the others read reverently. But most of us stood silently in this action. So that they were, you know, telling blatant lies, that's a further miscarriage of justice. I mean, they're bringing us in. And I would say, you know, at best it's misguided, but at worst it's really the government's attempt to silence us and to tamp down dissent.
So that's the first witness. He was cross-examined by your lawyer and by the other defendants?
We had already established that they had destroyed the tape that they had taken and that they could not find the tape.
Even before the first witness?
Yes, that was established.
They took a tape of what you did.
But what they were going to do, that they asked the court to accept, is a YouTube video that was taken by someone who we did not know, who we did not have in the court, who, of course, you know, enhanced sound. It's put up on YouTube, and it's edited. And they wanted to establish that it's just the same thing.
That's total hearsay. They can't do that.
Yeah.
They should know. It's shocking that they would even try to do that.
It is.
Well, the judge allowed it, and that worried me because I thought, that was it. It was over. It was only minutes.
He allowed that in.
The judge.
He allowed it, and we actually even then set up a screen. He had us delayed us, you know, sent us away, and we came back. And I have to say, at this point, the courtroom was packed because Witness Against Torture actually had to go in for their own hearing. Yeah. So the courtroom was packed with people with Shut Down Guantanamo and Arrest Bush, Arrest Cheney shirts, and We Will Not Be Silent. So
arrest Cheney first.
And arrest Cheney
That's
first.
Your shirt.
The screen was set up, and the prosecutor, you know, goes to set it up, and nothing projects.
I love it.
She cannot get it to project. It was like the theater of the absurd. And she's apologizing and fumbling, and I almost wanted to go up and help her plug it in and work with the electronics, because we had a full house and I wanted them to see what we had done. The judge then, we had to approach the bench and use her laptop and watch it on the laptop together. And of course, the sound, there was boom mics and the sound was enhanced. And this was her evidence that we were loud and disruptive.
I'm curious, do you think that the police realize their tape wasn't that compelling in terms of showing that you were disruptive and that they hid it or said they didn't have it for that reason?
Absolutely, because we were not disruptive. And if it caught what was happening and not enhanced in any way, the video, YouTube video, was enhanced so that people could view it and hear it. But it was probably had to be enhanced because we were not being loud. We were reading the names of the dead. And when we do that with reverence. We're bringing the evidence in a visual way to our representatives, but we are not in any way, you know, reading with a shouting and using obscenities or doing anything that would fall under that statute to try us on those charges.
So you see the video with the judge. What happens next?
My lawyer is now able to cross-examine, and he gets up and he asks one question. He said, "Do you take notes? Do you have a daily log?"
This is of the cop.
Of the cop. And he said, "Yes." He said, "So where are your notes?" And then it was all over.
Why? What happened? What did the cop answer?
He said they went away.
He said they went away?
They went away. And then the judge actually was going to ask him how soon could he get his book, his log book. And he said, well, I live 50 miles away. And the judge almost was going to postpone it until Thursday. And my lawyer just, you know, was enraged and said, absolutely not, and can't bring these people in again, and I live in New York, it's at great expense. So at that point, he went away for a few minutes and came back.
Who went away?
The judge. Uh-huh. The judge actually recessed for a few minutes, and then the prosecutor finally, he did not allow the witness. He struck the witness's testimony, her testimony.
Who?
So
the judge.
Right. And then it was over. Then yeah. It was that she had no witness and she had really no videotape.
So what happened? What happened when that moment happened in the courtroom? What was it like?
Oh, it was great. They had to, you know, warn us to to go take it outside. Right. But it was really exciting for everyone in there because it's a victory for everyone. As I say, it wasn't just the four of us that were on trial, but it really is. What is allowed of a free people who feel an urgency because war crimes are being committed in their time? What are we allowed as free people to do? And where do we go to seek justice?
And your feelings when you heard that it was over?
Well, I was, I'm glad it's over, but I was a little sorry that we couldn't mount our defense because I think we would have been acquitted and we would have gone through, taken it through to really get a chance to speak in that courtroom to what we were doing and what has to be done for the record. And that, I think, is very important that we keep a record of what's happening in this time.
What would you have said had you had the chance?
Good question, Michael.
I would have asked the question, if crimes are being committed, why would a decent people not speak up and raise their voices so they could be heard? And that, why is that a crime, that we are here speaking out against war crimes while the people who have committed the most heinous acts against human beings are set free now, are allowed to be free? Why are they not being prosecuted? Why are we in here being prosecuted by this Department of Justice? And we are appealing to Eric Holder and to our Justice Department to do what they've sworn to do, which is uphold the law. We're not being treated equally under the law, still.
Lori Arbeiter, you're our bravest comrade.
Right.
What are your future plans?
Sadly, Barack Obama said in Egypt that Iraq was a war of choice. And that, again, is a war of aggression, and therefore he should be prosecuting those that and finding out who set us on that path. But what, sadly now, Afghanistan is a war of choice. Pakistan is a war of choice. Iraq is a war of choice. It's his choice now. Guantanamo is his choice. Bagram, his choice. We're going to take that to his administration, to his home. And the March of the Dead, unfortunately, is gathering and is going to get longer, and the names from Pakistan will be included.
Is there a way for our listeners to reach you on a website?
Well, they can reach me at arrestbush@gmail.com.
Arrestbush@gmail.com. That will go directly to you, right, Lori?
Yes.
That's an email.
We will have a website that's being built now, wewillnotbesilent.net, and they should, yes, contact us because we do have plans.
And where do they get the T-shirts and what's the next one?
Wewillnotbesilent.net is being built now. We have several in the works, one that says greed kills.
What is it, greed kills?
Greed kills. And the new ones that we just brought out, Arrest Bush, Arrest Cheney, Arrest Rumsfeld, the new edition has the UN Conventions Against Torture. We've substituted that from the Articles of Impeachment because now it's under those conventions and other standards of law that we should prosecute them.
That's right. You gave me one of those wonderful T-shirts with the torture convention on the back.
Yes.
So if people want those, they go to?
To wewillnotbesilent.net. They can write to me now at arrestbush@gmail.com. Please do.
Lori, we've had you on here a number of times, and it's always refreshing and exhilarating and great for struggle.
Thank you. I look forward to coming back again.
Thank you, Lori.
Thanks, Lori. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Listeners may know, the Supreme Court recently declined to hear the case of the Cuban Five. The request for Supreme Court review, which included a record-setting 12 amicus briefs, received widespread international attention. It was possibly the Cuban Five's last chance for a new trial. The defense attorneys had argued that it was impossible for the men to get fair trials in Miami, where anti-Castro sentiment runs high, and that the convictions had to be overturned. Sadly, the Supreme Court said no. Joining us again to discuss the case is noted criminal defense attorney Leonard Wineglass, who represented the Cuban Five.
Len, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Unfortunately, with this visit, we have the very sad news of the Supreme Court's denial of cert in the case of the Five. Were you surprised by the decision?
When you understand that 98% of all petitions for cert are denied, you go into the process thinking it's very unlikely that you will get granted. That has to be the state of mind, and indeed that was ours. However, our position was so strongly stated and unprecedentedly joined by 11 briefs of friend of the court, including 10 Nobel Prize winners who filed a brief. I think Michael Ratner had a hand in that. That we became, as many litigators do, more optimistic when we saw the strength of our position. And then, of course, on June 15th, the news came down and it confirmed what we initially had suspected all along. So I must say it was a dispiriting experience to have the court reject it so out of hand without even a single written dissenting opinion, which you could get on a cert denial, but we didn't. Unfortunately, the Friday before the court sat down to consider our application, the Myers couple was arrested in Washington, with weekend news reporting in the Washington Post covering this situation of an elderly couple suspected of spying for Cuba. And we felt that didn't help us. As a matter of fact, when I read the full complaint in that case, it seemed likely to me that that arrest was precipitated possibly by our position in the court because the investigation was not complete. That's why the government has to take the position, which they now take, that they have no proof of what documents, if any, were sent. That's because the informant had gotten close to the couple, was apparently in their confidence, and was just beginning the process of finding out what had been sent when the arrest went down, which rarely happens in these cases. They usually wait until they get the smoking gun. Well, they never got it, but they moved very quickly, I believe, to make the arrest so that in the Friday news cycle before our case was considered, the court had before it another Cuban spying case.
You know, it's remarkable, Lenny, how they time these things. I mean, it was so obvious to me that that was the case. And you remember Obama gave his Guantanamo speech May 21st, and that morning, or that the day before, they announced the arrest of the so-called four Westchester alleged terrorists who were going to bring down a plane in Orange County or something, yes, right before the speech, as he was talking about preventive detention of Muslims, really. So they just do this stuff. It's terrible. But let's go back for a second to the denial, and I think we were all disappointed and all had, and I think you accurately portrayed it, because of the unprecedented support around the world, because of the quality of the briefs, particularly by your main brief writer, on the two, at least two of the big issues, one being the race issue, what we call the Batson issue on the jury, and the other being for the one defendant who was convicted of a conspiracy to commit murder and got a life sentence. There was just no evidence on this latter case that could have ever, that you could have ever come close to believing the guy was involved in shooting, purposely telling the Cubans to shoot down a plane in international airspace. So it was quite a shock. But can you just talk about those two issues, what they were?
Yes, Michael, as you indicate, the Batson issue, which is really the question of whether or not a representative of the government could racially move to exclude qualified African-American or minority jurors. Clearly, the law has developed that you cannot exclude minorities in employment. You cannot exclude them in housing. And, of course, it followed logically in 1986 when the Supreme Court got the issue that the government also can't exclude minorities in a courtroom, particularly when a minority is the accused. So in this particular case, the government followed a pattern, and the pattern was to permit several minorities on the jury who were elderly, less well-educated, as a kind of shield against the allegation that they were exercising their challenges in a racial fashion. When, if you look at the record, they removed seven younger, qualified, educated minority jurors. And so their plan was, as it always is, to allow a superficial grouping of minority jurors who they feel the other jurors can deal with and who they can deal with, and then claim because they have allowed that circumstance that there was no racial motivation in removing the others. Yeah. And we brought that sham very clearly to the court's attention because that's happening throughout the country. As a matter of fact, in Mumia's case, there was a film that was introduced into evidence by the district attorney's office. And that instruction film instructed the young district attorneys in Philadelphia to do just that, to permit several minority jurors who they felt could not withstand the pressures of the others, elderly, less well-educated, in Mumia's case, foreign-born, and use that as an argument that their other challenges were not racially motivated. When I saw it worked with Mumia, and Mumia's case was decided several weeks before ours, mm-hmm, his case was, if anything, a stronger Batson case than ours. And when I saw his getting denied, I became very concerned about our chances.
You know, one thing I didn't mention in the two issues, but the biggest issue, the community prejudice issue. Why was that case ever tried in Miami? And I think that to me is still probably the most shocking thing about this whole case.
That is shocking. And when you look at the history of this case, when we took our first appeal, we went before a three-judge panel, a federal panel in the 11th Circuit, a very conservative circuit, and the three judges had over 80 years of judicial experience collectively. They considered the case for 16 months and wrote a 93-page opinion unanimously saying, in this case, to have five agents of the Cuban government tried before a Miami jury represented, in their words, a perfect storm of bias and prejudice, and they reversed the entire case. That perfect storm on later appeals became a very mild, sunny day in Florida
right.
with a jury that was a model of fairness. It was shocking.
It is completely
bad. On the same record that they could reach that conclusion, but that's
happened. Even when jurors admitted that they would be afraid in that climate to rule otherwise.
Yes, several jurors said they would be afraid of their neighbors,
right.
and they would be afraid of the paramilitary groups in Miami who have carried out acts of violence, arsons and assaults against anyone who is perceived to be too friendly to Cuba.
Len, let's step back for a minute, though, to give listeners who may not be that familiar with the case of the Cuban Five some background. As I understand it, the Cuban gentlemen, five of them, came from Cuba to Miami to spy not on the American government, but to spy on these terrorists located in South Florida who were carrying on acts of aggression against Cuba. Could you expand on that for us, please?
Yes, you're right to point that out, Michael. The context of a case, particularly a political case, is very critical to an understanding of what's happening. And what happened in this particular instance is with the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1990 and Cuba falling into a condition of severe economic malaise, where even malnutrition for the first time became a problem for the revolution, the Cuban government in desperation reached out for the tourism industry to come to Cuba. They had sun, they had beaches, they had little else to offer the international community. And so Italian and Spanish, Brazilian and Canadian companies came, built five-star hotels along the beach in Cuba, and Cuba began to earn the hard currency of the tourist dollar, which began to pull it out of the economic doldrums going on into the mid-90s. However, the groups in Miami, the exile groups, which number over 750,000 residents, to be sure not all of them opposed to the Cuban Revolution, but some, who have formed these military wings and these paramilitary groups, which publicly operate and have training camps where they're filmed and it's on evening television, very similar to the training camps in Afghanistan. Uniformed members training with armed automatic weapons for carrying out attacks on Cuba. Those groups announced a public campaign to destroy the tourism industry in Cuba and to bring Cuba back onto its knees and defeat the revolution. They called a press conference in Miami and said, henceforth, all of Cuba will be considered free fire zone,
amazing.
Borrowing a term from Vietnam, where anything that moves, innocent and non-innocent, will be a target. And they did bomb the hotels. They killed an Italian tourist. They placed bombs in the new airport terminal, bombs in tourist buses, in nightclubs, and in public gathering places. Incidentally, none of it directed at military units in Cuba, a classic definition of international tourism, where innocent civilians became the target in order to achieve a political policy.
Yeah, example of terrorism.
Yes. And so Cuba protested each one of these acts. The United States did not respond. Cuba took the issue to the United Nations and read the speech by the Cuban ambassador, which preceded President Bush's formulation that any country that harbors terrorism is as bad as the terrorists themselves. and the United Nations did not act. They tabled it. It's still on the agenda of the Security Council. Following that, Cuba sent these five men whose purpose was to, as you suggest, to become a part of these organizations, to infiltrate them, and to report back to Cuba and to warn Cuba of oncoming violence, which they did. And I should say parenthetically, since their arrival and their work in the United States, there has not been a single act of terrorism in Cuba. So they did succeed. However, the FBI caught wind of their presence, and they were arrested and charged with espionage, which is really, by definition, an attempt to gain the secrets of the United States, which they weren't interested in. This is the first conspiracy to commit espionage case in which there was not a single classified document.
Wow.
Yet they were sentenced to life.
Some people have talked about what can happen now, and I understand that the Supreme Court doesn't reconsider, the lawyers can't ask them to reconsider this petition for cert. That only happens when there's a conflict of interest on the court, for example.
That's true.
What can we expect?
Well, the options become narrower. First, three are up for resentencing, and that should be accomplished probably in the August to September timeframe. I'm hopeful that those charged with espionage, like my client Antonio Guerrero, will not have a life sentence, but will get a set term of years. It remains to be seen what. I could say the outer range is 21 years to 27 years. That's the probability in his case and in the case of Ramon as well.
How many years have they done already?
10.
So out of the 21 to 27, which is possible.
Yeah, isolated from each other.
This judge has maxed
everybody on everything
up to this point in time.
And they're maxed even though they've taken away the conspiracy to commit espionage charge, right? They're now in on what's the high charge?
No, the charge remains.
Oh, conspiracy.
Conspiracy to commit espionage. But the appellate court found what was so obvious on the record that there was no top secret information that was passed to the Cuban government. That was absolutely clear.
Right.
There was no indication of that on the record, and yet the judge sentenced them as if it were.
Which, to a life sentence.
To so a this, life sentence, so because her position was a technical legal position. She felt that didn't matter. In her belief, the objective of the conspiracy was to obtain top secret information at some unspecified time in the future. Therefore, they qualified for life sentences. The appellate court, even the 11th Circuit felt this was ridiculous.
So that means they'll have served 10 out of the 21 to 27 they might get, but hopefully won't.
Will that time served be taken away from their sentences?
We believe so. You have to remember also, and I will argue this on the resentencing, number one, they should never have received a life sentence in the first place. That was clear error. Well, what does that mean? Having received a life sentence, my client was sent to a maximum security facility with the understanding that a life sentence in the federal system means that you never get out. So for the last 8 years, he's been living under the assumption that he will never return to his family. That's hard time. When you add to that the fact that he was in a maximum facility where, because it is such a facility, there was a constant lockdown. 30% of the time that he served in that facility, he was locked in his cell 23 hours a day. Wow. So he did hard time on top of hard time. That's a factor this judge should consider, because she erroneously sent him there when she tries to resentence him in September. And hopefully that will bring a better result.
And also the UN Commission on Human Rights has mentioned this, and it's the only time, isn't it, in a criminal trial that they've gone on record as saying it was unfair, and also that the conditions arose essentially to torture in some instances, the conditions of their earlier confinement.
You're right, Heidi. For the first time in the history of the United Nations, they have issued an opinion on a case in the United States, and that was in May of 2005. And after receiving briefs from both sides, five judges who are part of a subcommittee of the UN Commission on Human Rights made a finding that they were unfairly tried in Miami. And they entered an order asking the United States to correct the injustice of that decision. And, of course, the United States has never responded to that commission.
I may be wrong on this, but I heard that the government actually urged the Supreme Court not to grant cert.
Very strongly.
Is that usual?
Well, we were, again, hoping against a lot of experience that teaches otherwise, that the Obama administration would lighten up on this case and acknowledge some of the undisputed facts about the case and bring that to the attention of the court to indicate together with ourselves the unprecedented nature of this case. That was not to be. If anything, the briefs against us filed by the Obama administration were stronger than the briefs that we'd encountered up to this point.
You know, we've talked about, on and off, discriminatory treatment against the Cuban Five compared to particularly how people involved in either Cuban terrorism in Cuba are treated in the United States, as well as how similar or analogous kind of cases are much worse cases by people aiding Israel in some way. Can you give us some recent examples of that?
Well, the most recent example is the case of Ben-Ami Khadish, who pled guilty to passing top-secret information to agents of the Israeli government. Mr. Khadish had worked at the Picatinny Arsenal in New Jersey in a research center, and he had a top-secret clearance. He obtained top-secret documents in the period 1979 to 86 pertaining to the modification of the F-15, which is a top-flight fighter of the U.S. Air Force, the development of the Patriot missile when it was in its developmental stages, as well as nuclear weapons. Passing nuclear information does carry the death penalty. He pled guilty to the charges, and he came up for sentencing last month, and he received a suspended sentence and a $50,000 fine. He inexplicably has $1 million in assets without anyone stating how he accumulated such wealth. But when the court told him he would face a $50,000 fine, his response was, no problem, Judge.
Oh, my gosh. That's a really horrendous case.
But
go back. There is another case, a recent case, in which AIPAC, the Israeli lobby, the American Israeli lobby, there were two of their people who were accused, at least, of taking secrets from a official within the Bush administration at the Pentagon.
Yeah.
And I think all of them essentially never went to jail. I'm not sure what happened in that case,
yes.
Do you recall?
What happened was the official you referred to, I believe his name is Walker, but I'm not sure because there's another case named Walker, of course, which I'm familiar with. But he was an employee within the Department of Defense, and he provided these AIPAC members, who you referred to, with classified information pertaining to the military posture of the Islamic Republic of Iran. He was prosecuted. He pled guilty, and he was sentenced to, I believe, 10 years in prison. He revealed the names of the AIPAC members who he gave the information to. They were indicted. He came up for resentencing because he had cooperated. After serving several years, his sentence was reduced to either 6 or 8 years, and he's about now scheduled, I believe, or about to be scheduled for release. The two AIPAC members who were indicted, the Obama administration did dismiss the indictments against them. So that case has ended with one person, the employee in the United States, going to prison for a short time, and the AIPAC members getting no prison time at all.
And Len, there's one last example that I think we should articulate, and that's the case of Luis Posada Carriles, who I understand has now had his trial put off until 2010. Can you elaborate on that for us?
Yes, Posada Carriles has a long-standing association with the CIA, which his attorney acknowledged in court papers and claimed he still has an association with the CIA, is quite a character out of the history of U.S. relations with Cuba and with Venezuela and Latin America, because Carriles was involved in the bringing down of the first commercial jet plane in mid-flight as a result of a bomb that was planted on board, killing all aboard in 1976 and I think 73.
That was a Cuban
were killed.
Airliner.
Right. Yeah. Cubana airline, a commercial airline, with a regular run from Venezuela to Barbados and then on to Cuba. The plane went down mid-flight. The bomb exploded. It was C-4. It was incidentally placed in a toothpaste container left in the men's room. When you board a flight and you wonder why they seized your toothpaste, you should be reminded that this was the first mid-air explosion of a commercial jet, but they don't talk about it.
That's
it's
all
never
it took
mentioned.
Was the amount of C-4 in a tube of toothpaste?
It would be enough to blow. The plane did not go down precipitously. Uh-huh. The tail assembly, the restroom in an airplane is in the tail.
Right.
The tail assembly was damaged. There are tapes of the pilots announcing to ground control that they had lost control of the plane, and the plane eventually plummeted into the ocean. So it was enough to damage control of the plane and bring the plane down. Carriles was named by the people who placed the toothpaste in the plane as the person who had paid them to do it. And that person, incidentally, is a cab driver in Caracas, Venezuela, and is available to the media because he did his time and he's out, but he named Carriles and one other, Posada, both of them living in Miami now, Posada living under threat of prosecution, not for this episode, the first terrorism bringing down of a commercial plane, but for relatively minor charges, the other having no charges whatsoever, but having been granted by Bush Sr. Permanent residence in the United States, thanks to Jeb Bush, who intervened on his behalf.
It's also worth mentioning that he actually escaped prison in Venezuela, where he was convicted.
Correct. He escaped prison with the help of unknown persons. Then he was employed by the CIA in El Salvador during the Contra War, working under Oliver North. He has quite a checkered history, Heidi. You're correct to point that out. Here was a man who was charged with the murder of 73 people, who escaped prison. What next became his employment? Hired by the CIA, paid by the U.S. taxpayer to help in the war against the elected government of Nicaragua.
Lenny, I want to put the Cuban Five in a broader context, political, because obviously it looks like, at least other than the resentencing, the legal options have narrowed significantly since the denial. Where do you see this case fitting politically in the slight, very slight changes going on with the U.S. and Cuba right now? What can we hope for, at least, or what should we be pushing for going forward?
Well, there are two things. One, there is a legal option available to us under what's called Federal 18 U.S.C. 2255, what is always known as federal habeas. In other words, we could raise, and we have up to 1 year to raise it, we could raise constitutional issues, only constitutional issues, that haven't previously been raised. For instance, the claims of venue, which you mentioned, and the claims of Batson are out. They were raised, litigated. We cannot re-raise them. Are there other claims that we can raise that have not been litigated? Usually these are claims that have arisen since the case had begun and while it was under appeal. And the answer to that is there are, and we are now exploring those. We have 1 year in which to file, and we will be making a decision as to when and how we file those claims. So we're not completely out of court. although what's called the direct appeals are over. We now have a process that's called the collateral appeals, the collateral attack on constitutional grounds, which we have up to 1 year to file. What should people be doing now? I think the ball is really in the court of the Obama administration. Obama said something very interesting, which is quoted in this New York Times on the front page. He said, "Those who stand up for justice are on the right side of history." Well, that's a very good quote. I'm glad the president has spoken so eloquently about that, because I think people should stand up for justice in this case, and to bring some sense to the Obama administration about what really happened here. If this incident occurred over Cuban airspace, the Cubans had every right under international law to shoot these aircraft down. And finally, we got a federal judge after nearly 10 years to say that. But she said it. She's an 85-year-old jurist. She's been on the bench for over 45 years. She has a wonderful history of having graduated near the top of her class at Penn Law School, having been passed over by all the law firms in Philadelphia, finding no employment, going back to Georgia, setting up practice in her hometown, which is a small town, working in the vineyards of that particular legal situation until Jimmy Carter became the president of the United States, knowing of her in rural Georgia, elevating her right onto the Court of Appeals, where she's been sitting for, I would say, at least 35 years. So we got her opinion, and that's something that people ought to be familiar with. The charge of conspiracy is bogus. The charge of conspiracy to commit murder is outrageous, and people should be mobilizing. It's up to the Obama administration to finally recognize the reality here of what happened and to begin the process of returning the five home.
Well, Lenny, thank you very much, and for staying, obviously, as the lawyer in this case for so many years. It's saddening, but it's great that you've done that.
Yes, well, it's been my privilege to stand with them. They're five brave men.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.